The novel Anna Karenina begins, "Happy families are all alike. All unhappy families are unhappy in their own way." I've always loved that line because it isn't just about families, I don't think. It's pointing to something we all already know, which is that happiness, when you're experiencing it, feels pretty simple, and usually its causes are easy to explain. If you're having a bad time, though, you might be the first person in history ever to have had that problem. Each sad is tragically unique. And it's one thing to be sad, it's another to be sad about something odd and strange enough that you're convinced you'll never be able to properly explain it to another human being. But I'ma give it a go. Please get a beer if you'd like to. I'm feeling turbo pretentious. This might be a longie. About 10 years ago, I fell into one of my first I'm quite sad and I don't know why periods. I have, of course, since learned that everyone else gets them too, but at the time I was even more of a self-involved idiot than I am today and believed I was special for them. 21 is a good age for that. The problem is obvious in retrospect. I'd just finished reading a load of the books that would go on to define my 20s, the writers I still love, Margaret Atwood, Arthur C. Clarke, Gabriel Garcia Marquez and co, and had spiralled into realising the fantasy I'd been harbouring since I was about 13 of one day learning to write that brilliantly, that beautifully, precise like Virginia Woolf, but vulgar and funny like Hunter S. Thompson. It was impossible. They were the greats, I was an unremarkable and frankly, hygienically, subversive dweeb. The problem was that I didn't want to do anything else. The dream of one day writing one great thing with a capital G, something perfect I could always point to as proof that not all of me was ugly, that even ogres can tend a nice garden, that was all I've wanted to do since I started reading properly. It felt like the same thrill, I imagine, as wanting to scale a mountain no one has ever been up before, or go mess around down in the Mariana Trench, to be the first stranger to arrive in a strange land, and I was just then becoming aware of how unlikely and impossible it was, because I sucked at writing, but I'd only just noticed. A housemate saw I was a bit sad and restless and showed me a film called Into the Wild. It's the biopic of a real man, Christopher McCandless, who decided he was done with society and traipsed off to commune with nature. To spoil it for you, it's not really a spoiler, it's a guy's life, he died, tragically and preventably, and alone in Alaska. But the only part I remembered, the only part everyone in their 20s who sees that film seems to remember, was the wilderness thing, and I decided immediately that I would like to go and be alone, preferably in nature, preferably for a long time, because I wasn't made for society, etc, etc, and out there, for some reason, I would be unburdened and finally happy forever, or at least hopefully escape this weird crisis I'd fallen into. So, a few months later, I blew the remains of my student loan on a plane ticket and found myself in New Zealand, because that seemed wildernessy, feeling rather bitter and anxious and lost geographically and spiritually. I very much wanted to go commune with nature. I was sure that would fix something. I spent about a year volunteering on farms on New Zealand's South Island. There was an organic farm program called WOOF, W-O-O-F, it still exists, big recommend. And before what I say next, I really should stress that I never had a bad time doing it. Everyone was lovely, except the first farm I worked on. It was run by a British couple. The only thing they hated more than their farm was each other. They despised each other with the same passion new lovers adore each other. It was an art to watch. They had moved to the middle of nowhere hoping to escape their problems and found, when they arrived, that they, in fact, were their problems. I'd get up around 5, milk the goats, build fences, get yelled at for a few hours by the husband for, and I'm not joking, quote, treating the animals too nicely, then listen to a 3-hour lecture about how agriculture was going to collapse, and they alone would be the ones to preserve the light of humanity in their post-apocalyptic utopia. If I worked very hard, they told me, they would even let me live there when the end times came. I would rather drink paint, I thought to myself. I would rather have my balls torn off by the blood-drinking zombies of tomorrow's water wars than have to spend even another day with either of you vicious, bitter chuckle fucks, apocalypse or not. One evening, they took issue with me writing an email to my parents because they explained that was anti-isolationist, and I decided it had been horrible and everything, but I was very done and negotiated getting the hell out. On the last day, as an act of what they announced was terribly kind of them, they let me plant the bulbs for that year's flower garden. I waited until they were out of view, then spent the next 4 hours laboriously arranging bulbs into the worst words I could think of. Fuck, jubblies, centipede dong, etc. I like to think that one day, a few weeks later, they were having their morning cup of piss-weak coffee and looked wistfully out to the flower garden and noticed my handiwork pushing up through the soil, then both spontaneously combusted. I worked for quite a few more families and farms, and really, everyone else was incredibly kind, and each time was different. Some days you were maintaining vineyards, other days building a house. Go and volunteer with WOOF or Workaway or whatever if it sounds up your street. Most people are very friendly. It's big fun. One good thing came out of that initial hellish experience, though. The professionally depressed British couple I worked for first had begrudgingly given me the number of a woman a few hundred miles away who owned a yurt. That's a Mongolian tent in the middle of, much to my wilderness dreams excitement, nowhere, and she rented it out from time to time. So when I got done with farms, I phoned her, and she sounded nice and said, sure, come live here. So I bought every book I've ever wanted to read, got on a bus, and lived there. It was perfect, miles from the nearest town. I spent weeks doing nothing but wandering around in my birthday suit, reading and writing. It's very nice to be young and on a mission, even when it feels like an impossible one, especially when all you need is some paper and a pencil. I remember lots of evenings in that yurt, reading by candlelight, then spending the whole of the next day trying to write and accidentally, inevitably imitating whoever I'd been reading the night before. There was the Hemingway week when the sky was wide and the trees were juiced on steroids and every metaphor involved bullfighting and whiskey. There was the Jane Austen week when the countryside was positively refulgent and I ate so little fibre that I did not shit for perhaps 2 days short of a fortnight. A strange thing happened with the yurt, though. A few months in, and the novelty wore off, and I noticed I was going slightly insane. No wilderness euphoria had appeared. Whatever hermit's Shangri-La I'd imagined was nowhere to be found. I didn't feel any better about the writing thing, nor my prospects at doing it. And worse, I missed people. It was weird. I began to realise I didn't even know what I'd been searching for in the first place. The stranger thing was that my, I suppose, landlady and I got really close. She was my mum's age and her daughter had just left home, and I think maybe she saw me as a kind of surrogate son, I don't know. But when she was in town every few weeks, we'd go walking and hang out a lot. She was very kind, very clever, and very humble, quietly nodding and smiling at my stupid 21-year-old musings about how the world works, never teasing me for being an idiot, which I was. I remember her going quiet for a while when I eventually admitted what had started this entire freakout. Then she said very gently, "You will work this out, but it's going to take some time and you have to be okay with that." Well, turned out I wasn't okay with that, so I ignored this advice completely, because she was only more than twice my age. What did she know? One day, I walked into town and chanced on a book about a hiking route in the US called the Appalachian Trail. The trail was very long, apparently, but marked and maintained well. It was secluded, but occasionally passed near towns. It seemed insane, but people had done it before and lived. I quickly became obsessed with the idea of a massive hike, specifically the Appalachian Trail. Perhaps that was what I was missing. It would be like living in the wilderness, just more exercisey. But I could hardly just piss off to America, so I decided I'd go do some hiking in New Zealand instead. The day I left the yurt, my landlady drove me to the bus stop. We were both very quiet, the mood was very somber, and when we hugged goodbye, I noticed she was crying, and I was too, if I'm honest. I realised I had made a friend, and that, ironically, she was the part I really enjoyed about trying to go and be alone. An obvious truth was staring me in the face, but I was far, far too young and stupid to apprehend it. It would take another half my lifetime to work it out. Anyway, I still think of my landlady today. I hope you're doing okay, Mrs. Brown. The hike was even more disastrous than my other plans, weeks of getting lost, weeks of knowing it was a stupid idea, but having too much pride to give up. My tent let the rain in, my shoes rubbed, I had no idea what I was doing. Still, I carried it on until my body gave up on me, then I gave up on me, really, and went off to have, well, not a life, but a bumbling improvisation of one anyway. Then 10 years passed in the way 10 years does, and the writing thing did somehow become my job. The wilderness fantasies went away for a while, or at least it was much easier to get lost in the silly forests within. Still, once again, older and not any wiser then, I found myself lost 10 years on. I just finished writing a book, the one about ocelots, if you know it, and I was a mess. I'd become so obsessed with trying to finish something that was unfinishable, I had lost the plot, literally, drinking with inadvisable enthusiasm, sleeping on sound insulation foam in the room where I write, because that was the only place I could sleep without feeling guilty about not working, unable to finish the thing, yet unable to let it go. In hindsight, I should have just let it go. It was one of the worst things I've ever written. In any case, I'd gone quite bonkers, and by the time the book was finished, I was pretty finished too. I couldn't write another word, couldn't find any enjoyment in it, which was a bit of an issue, since writing had become the one thing in the world that makes sense to me. It's the one thing that makes all the other things nice, not to mention pays my rent. Nothing worked. I hated and abandoned everything I started, second-guessing myself the whole time. This went on for months. Luxury problems, I know, but it felt very real at the time. The problem is that one's imagination and sense of purpose can't be bargained with or cajoled, and when they stop firing for some reason, it feels like suffocation, as you may unfortunately already know. They don't respond to reason, you just have to sit tight and wait to feel human again. There are workarounds, of course there are, but yes, your self-worth goes summarily down the toilet, along with the ability to play. And that's what had left me. The fun, the playing, the silly daydreams I've been retreating to since I was little. I'm sure you know those daydreams too, and without them, the real world is far too cold and bleak, and I'm far too boring and cynical to live in it anyway. And all of this was a sort of fun adventure into a mild early 30s melancholy episode, until I noticed if I was reading or looking at something close up, it would take ages for my eye to focus normally again when I look away. I say I because only my right eye can see anything. The left is a sort of cosmetic bonus, so as you can imagine, I'm quite protective of old righty. Visiting an optometrist seemed like a good idea. It happened to be the day of my 32nd birthday. Eye exams are about as exciting as birthdays in your 30s get, apparently. And the optometrist scanned my eye with fancy equipment and buffed it and varnished it, God knows, and said, "Nope, everything's fine." And I said, "Yeah, but it's not working. It takes ages to focus now." And he looked down at my notes and said, "Oh, it's your birthday today." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Happy birthday. You're getting old," which I thought was extremely funny and useless and funny, but I must admit it added a whole new dimension to the whole freaking out about writing thing. Shouldn't I have written something good by now? I've had ages. I'm not old yet, but I'm hardly young anymore. What the hell am I playing at? I was supposed to have done a thing by now, a thing I liked, a thing I was proud of. Fucking optometrists. So I was a bit glum and getting glummer. A friend noticed the cheese had completely slid off my cracker and said, "You need to go and do something else for a while, something that isn't worrying about work, otherwise you're going to break some stuff on the inside permanently." It came to me immediately, a decade in the making, all the into the wild wilderness Henry David Thoreau living off the land stuff. And remembering that book I found in New Zealand 10 years before, I said, "I'll walk the Appalachian Trail." "That's the one with bears, isn't it?" my friend said. "Just a few months," I said. "I won't take a laptop, no pens or paper. I'll go walk the Appalachian Trail." And she said, "Yeah, I meant go to the beach for a weekend. And isn't that the one with bears?" The Appalachian Trail travels through 14 states and climbs the equivalent elevation of doing Everest 16 times. Several thousand people walk it every year, and it's hardly obscure. There are movies about it now, but a lot less people actually end up finishing the whole thing. I had no intention of finishing it anyway. I just wanted to keep walking until I felt better, and secretly, more importantly, until I could write again. That was my plan, taking a vacation while actually secretly working the whole time and no one could stop me. I looked into it, and weirdly, walking the trail would cost even less than life at home. I wouldn't have to pay rent since I'd be sleeping in a tent, most of the gear I'd need I owned already, and I managed to find an obscenely cheap flight over to Atlanta, near where the trail begins if you're walking northbound. There was no reason not to do this, so suddenly realizing how stupid what I was doing was, in March of last year, I found myself descending into Atlanta. A few nights later, I nervously laid everything out on my hotel bed, food and long johns and toilet paper, and realized this was it. This was going to be my life for a while, everything I owned in a backpack in the woods. What the fuck did I think I was doing? Then, the next morning, my uncertainty reaching maximum, I ended up at Amicalola Falls State Park, where the trail begins. I got my bag weighed by the kind rangers at the park, 30 pounds, bang on about 20% of one's body weight, though it felt like carrying a dead rhino. Chatted for a bit to a few other hikers who looked as nervous as I felt about what in the hell was coming next, and then, well, one by one, we all just started walking. The path was busy for a while, families out for the day, a rather arduous climb up a waterfall, then soon enough it all gave way to forest, and I was alone. The first 8 miles aren't the Appalachian Trail, it's the approach trail to get onto the main trail, and I don't know if it's designed like this, but rather cleverly it kicks your ass just enough to make sure if you're not supposed to be out there, you'll know it. My pack was obscenely heavy, hundreds of miles of this, I couldn't imagine another 5. I'd trained a few times a week for the trail for about a month before, walking up the mountain that sits conveniently a few tram stops from my apartment. It was always fun, throwing a few sandwiches and a thermos of coffee into a backpack and leisurely wandering up to the peak. And each time I'd be thinking, "Man, I am so ready for this Appalachian thing." And I probably would have been if a sandwich and a thermos of coffee and a misguided confidence in my feeble sit-at-a-desk-all-day legs was all I'd be taking along with it. In reality, with long hikes, you have your life on your back, and that changes things enormously. Imagination is limitless. Spinal vertebrae are not. And within just that first hour on the real trail, I was learning not to write checks with my mouth that my ass couldn't cash. By midday, it got rather warm. The path passed the stream, and I filtered some water from it. Cold and indescribably refreshing, a ritual that had soon become one of my favourite parts of the day, and carried on into the woods. I walked until it started getting dark and stopped at a campsite. Four or five other hikers had already set up for the night. I bimbled about trying to remember how to actually lay a ground sheet and actually put up a tent, hardly failing to notice everyone else seemed to know exactly what they were doing, and finally crawled into my tent and slept better than I have in half a decade. Then I woke when the sun rose and settled into the rituals I would do every morning for the next while, not least of all making coffee. Having planned the walk for a while, I'd decided most of my addictions could go. I could give up the occasional Sunday cigarette, the weekday beers too, but if you can't have a cup of coffee in the morning, what really is the point in being alive? Exactly, there simply fucking isn't one. As a general rule, I thrive on clutter and chaos, but even I, that first morning and all the mornings that followed, revelled in the simple joy of knowing where everything goes in one's backpack while breaking camp. The Swiss Army knife and water filter, the toothbrush and socks, all with their own little nooks and pockets, then the even sublimer joy of putting that backpack on and knowing it's all you own on that continent. And that first morning, things began to feel real. My calves and ass hurt a bunch, but I'd woken up in the woods that morning and would be going to sleep in the woods that night. Something was very exciting about that. It was also rather exciting to find my shoes and pack worked fine. If you care about this sort of thing, I didn't until I started the trail. I used an Osprey Exos 48 backpack and walked in luminous yellow Ultra Lone Peak 6s. I cannot recommend both enough, they almost never gave me any trouble. I ate noodles on a rock for lunch, amazed at how good packet noodles suddenly taste after a morning of walking, then set off walking again, thinking over and over, how are humans allowed to be out here? Until it threatened to get dark and set up camp alone this time. I'd camped alone quite a few times before, but never this far into the woods, and never in America. Right, I thought, the woods falling more or less pitch black, my tiny tent and me probably smelling like whatever the equivalent of McDonald's is for bears, which is regular McDonald's, I guess. What the fuck am I doing out here? Surprisingly, the woods are actually quite loud at night, or the sound anyway. Owls gossiping to each other, wind poking at the canvas of your tent, things crawling by or mincing by just a few feet from your head. You're in nature's house after all. But something feels primitively safe about a sleeping bag, maybe the same comfort of enclosure we derived from caves, I don't know, but somehow a few layers of polyester feels enough to keep you safe from whatever you imagine is coming to eat your eyeballs. And that was the shape of my life for the next a while. I would wake, drink a bucket of coffee, set off, have lunch above a gorgeous view, walk until I was done, and set up camp just like I had the night before. I watched the sun go down, I boiled rice, and then I got into my sleeping bag and read. I read, I should add, like I haven't read since I was 15, using my head torch, cozy in long johns. It was quite cold at night in Georgia in March, and that only made things even cozier, clinging to every word like it was my first time holding a book. I had forgotten how to read like that. Things I put down halfway through a few years before, a load of Steinbeck stuff, Light by M. John Harrison, suddenly everything was enthralling. Then all the stuff I reread just because I could, A History of the First Nautical Clocks, A Fire Upon the Deep, I devoured everything I could find by David Thorne, the guy behind 27B/6, just read it all, he's fucking hilarious. But in general, everything was better for reading properly, and amid the almost silence of the forest, and knowing there's nowhere else to look for entertainment but your brain, and I'd had quite enough of hanging out there. Sometimes you'd be sharing a campsite or a clearing with other hikers, and sometimes they'd come and say hello, and it really was that easy. This will sound insane, but getting ready for the trip, I hadn't been worried about bears or dehydration, but other hikers, that I'd have to talk to them. I've learned, as every introvert eventually does, to try and mimic being outgoing, and I hope I do a halfway passable impression, but to this day, meeting new people still feels like having all of my RAM used up by a program I don't understand. It's very stressful, and I wasn't looking forward to that. This is not how it went down. In life, you're bumping into people coming from a thousand different contexts. Maybe they've had a bad day, maybe you have, maybe they're trying to scam you, maybe they're just being nice for no reason, but it takes ages to work out which game you're both playing. On the trail, there is only one context, and that is the trail. And just as you've chosen to go and live in the woods for a while, so have they. This commonality makes every conversation immediately easy, because you know what they're doing there. They know what you're doing there. You're both going the same way. Everyone I met was lovely anyway. About a week in, and a kind of hiking zen descended. By hour three or four of walking in the mornings, and things would turn up in one's mind's eye. Daydreams, nostalgia, old friends, old plans, lots of cringe, lots of ghosts. One ghost in particular. I remembered myself 10 years previously, also out in the woods, considerably more naive, but was I any smarter now, really? I felt just as lost. Here I was for round two in some stupid self-created crisis, thousands of miles from home again, isolating myself again for lack of any other approach I could think of. Nothing had changed. I was still the same idiot. And one morning, tying my laces, from nowhere I realized it was dead-endedness that was doing me in. That was why writing the last book had demolished me. It wasn't working on it that had sucked. I like working if it's on something fun. Rather, it was the hope that if I could pour myself into this thing, if I could write somehow truthfully enough or resoundingly enough, it would be a salvation somehow. It would make me undirty, and I would wake up the next morning fixed, or at least better, and finally a real person. I woke up that next morning when the book was finished and released and found I was still me. It was the hardest thing I've ever done, and it still didn't work, meaning probably nothing would work. That's what had sent me mad. That's what I was doing in the woods, because if the one thing I enjoyed wouldn't work, I'd have to find something else. How ridiculous it seemed suddenly to put so much pressure on oneself, like that ever resulted in any good work. How had I forgotten that daydreaming was supposed to be fun? It wasn't there to monetize or bolster one's ego. It's for fun. It's for playing. Somewhere along the way, I must have forgotten how to play, and that was stupid, and I was stupid. I thought of a line, Ursula K. Le Guin, the greatest writer to ever live in my opinion, and if anyone disagrees they're objectively wrong, had said just before she died, talking about writing. The name of our beautiful reward is not profit, its name is freedom. And maybe it was the sheer, almost offensively beautiful forest, maybe it was the joy of still having enough toilet paper for the next few days left, but a new thought hit me, a hopeful one, which was that at least I've never been particularly confused about what I wanted to do, not generally. Ever since I was a teenager, I knew I would either aim for a life of doing stuff with words, because I love them, because they are music, because stories are really just metaphysical investigations of reality with characters thrown in, or I would spend the rest of my life trying to do that. It was non-negotiable. No other job or path has ever made sense to me. I don't know why it's this way, but it's always been this way. How lucky I am, I realized, that either by biological accident or miswired brain and a lack of character, that I am like this. I know lots of people who aren't, who just never had an obsessive calling. And they're doing fine. Often they're sensible and pay their bills and seem quite happy with their lives, but a sensible life had never really appealed to me. I am simply too incompetent. Even if it's fruitless, I like that feeling of walking towards the mountain of one day I might actually make a beautiful thing. I don't know how else I could have lived. I was unfathomably lucky, I realized suddenly, for having that compulsion, even if it occasionally spiraled off into borderline madness and self-pity in the woods of Georgia, as it had now, as it had on another continent 10 years before, as it may well 10 years hence. But I was lucky. I probably should keep that in mind, I thought. I finished tying my laces and looked out to whatever absurdly gorgeous view was below. Then I put my backpack on, set off walking again, and didn't think about writing for weeks. For the first while on the trail, it was impossible not to play a quiet mental game of, I wonder who will be dropping out. It almost never worked. One evening, I watched a couple walk into camp, apparently having packed for an Antarctic expedition, carrying enormous bags of fruit and the sort of elaborate fold-up chairs one takes to festivals. Well, they won't last, I thought to myself. I met the couple a few weeks later. They were doing fine, minus the chairs and bags of fruit, but doing fine all the same. Other folks, ripped like Hercules, positively hopping up mountains, would suddenly drop out from random injuries or just not vibing with the woods. There was no pattern to it. Barring injury, the only signifier I ever found reliable for whether someone would stick with it was whether or not they wanted to. Eccentrics seemed to have a special advantage, and the trail was full of benevolent eccentrics. One guy who wore a kilt I never got to know, but we hiked at roughly the same speed and kept bumping into each other. I fondly remember climbing a rather unpleasant mountain and him already having reached the peak. We did it, he yelled, and offered his hand in congratulations. I went to shake it and realized he was using his other hand simultaneously to take a piss, which I found more charming and demonstrating of character than I can tell you. I walked also for a while with a Californian gentleman who I immediately fell in bro love with. We parted one morning when he suggested getting stoned might make the day's hike a little easier. I declined, not particularly wanting to get off my tits for breakfast. Then, setting off, I went to find him again, and by then he'd inducted some new friends into his wake and bake. They were sitting in silence in the shelter with extremely red eyes. You're not walking today, are you? I said. He shook his head and opened a bag of marshmallows. I never saw him again. In my experience, this was how friendships worked on the trail. They got deep and honest rather quickly, but were also ephemeral and without expectation. Another friend I met was an artist from New York, a brilliant one, one of those irritating people who claims they dabble a bit, then presents the fucking Mona Lisa to you. We walked together for a few days, having a wonderful time moaning about our respective birth nations. Then he stopped in town for a day, and I carried on walking and assumed we wouldn't meet again. It snowed a week later, heavily enough that walking in it seemed like an extremely bad idea. I set up my tent and hunkered down for a day of reading about Richard Feynman's various exploits and eating Pop-Tarts. Near sundown, I heard someone setting up near me, and they came over to ask if I wanted them to brush the snow off my tent. We chatted through the tent for a bit, then he gingerly said my name. Gingerly, I said his back. I got out, and of course it was my artist friend from New York. As I remember it, we did a sort of impromptu reunion dance in the snow, the sort dogs do when you take the lead off the wall for a walk. Deprived of any other entertainment, freezing our balls off, it was a party. A good one too. And deprivation is the name of the game. Maybe I'm misremembering it, but there's a theory of Lacan's that I quite like, that we don't desire things, we desire to feel desire itself. The thing is incidental. Deprivation is a rather fun way of gaming your desire protocols. After a week in the woods, a stray Oreo in one's food bag is a banquet. Having just enough battery left for your phone to kick your ass at chess is about as entertaining as an evening of gin tonics. One day I was getting a bit miserable about a blister and looked down at my shoes and noticed those little holes at the top no one ever seems to use. Experimentally, I threaded my laces through them and just never got blisters again. This felt like an achievement tantamount to discovering cold fusion. It was the best thing that had happened in weeks. Another treat to look forward to was trail magic. Sometimes you'd be coming down a mountain, swearing to yourself about ever having been born in the first place, and there in the road, some ex-hikers or just inexplicably kind humans would have set up tables for coffee and donuts and biscuits and everything you'd been fantasizing about, expecting no money in return, and would gladly stand and chat to you too. It was miraculous. There was another day close to a miracle. You meet lots of section hikers on the trail, people just out for the day or the weekend. I got talking to some older guys out for a catch-up walk with each other. They teased me extensively about the Boston Tea Party, and I teased them extensively about what their country calls beer, which is bullshit, by the way. It's just European snobbery. Americans know exactly what they're doing with beer these days. Their IPA game is on point. Anyway, these older gentlemen said, "Well, if you stop at the campsite near where our truck is, the beer's on us." I assumed this was a joke and tried not to think about it. I'm not a foodie. I didn't miss falafel or curry. I only craved one thing in the woods, and that was beer. Not to get hammered, not even to take the edge off the day, but just that one cold beer to round off doing something difficult. I thought about it constantly. We got to the campsite and said our goodbyes, and the older guys wandered off to their truck, maybe a few kilometers walk away. I set up my tent and stared into space for quite some time. About 40 minutes later, an enormous Texan hand reached into my tent, offering a can of IPA. One of those older guys had walked not an inconsiderable distance just to go and get me a beer, just to be kind, then just to walk all the way back to their truck again. I practically shat myself with gratitude. That evening, I watched the sun go down, drinking what was, without any contest, the greatest beer of my life. I think what most hikers were enjoying out there was pretty identical to the kick I was getting, which was the constant sense that you're all on an adventure. Because on balance, it is very pleasant to wander without being lost, to plan without foresight, to spend a few days alone and getting sick of one's company, then chance on the best company you've had in an age. I was feeling a bit lonely and camping by a stream one evening when a guy passed going for water. We established we were both readers, and somehow we got around to a shared love of the thinker David Graeber. When I checked my watch, about 3 hours had gone by. We went back up the hill to where his girlfriend had built a fire, then two more hikers joined while we all presumably played a private mental game of, "Is anyone here a murderer?" Then, satisfied it was unlikely, we watched the dark fold in around us until the campfire was the only visible light in the whole of the woods, and here we were, strangers, occupying a tiny orange universe together. There was nothing outside, just each other to trust. Many nights were that way. I came to enjoy the feeling very much. I won't pretend there weren't low periods. I won't pretend there weren't unsettling periods. One night I woke to the sound of something large and not exactly human wandering around in the near vicinity of my tent. I'm told black bears are fairly harmless as long as they don't think their cubs are in danger, but I didn't sleep great the rest of that night. There was really only one day when things went wrong, and how wrong they went. The trail is marked all the way to Maine with white blazes of paint on trees that tell you if you're on the right path. It's hard to miss them. One evening, I was eavesdropping on two hikers talking about how one of them had briefly gotten lost that day and thought to myself, "Come on, how do you wander off a marked path?" The universe was listening though, and she has a dark sense of humour. The next day, I was trying to make more miles than I probably should have and was rushing. I turned at a white blaze, and after a while the path started to look a bit spotty in places. The blazes disappeared, but maybe they hadn't been that well maintained. Besides, I'd just come down a hill and had no interest in walking all the way back up it. Another mile or so and the path disappeared completely. I turned around and realised I couldn't even find the path back the way I'd come. Stay calm, I thought, you can't be that far from the trail. Only, I could. I'd just walked maybe a few miles in the wrong direction somehow and had no idea which direction I'd come from. I wandered cautiously for about an hour and found nothing, rather aware I was only getting myself more lost and further from the trail. The weeks before, the woods had always felt big, but homely somehow. You didn't know where you'd end up, but you knew where you were going. Suddenly, the woods were still very big, but that bigness felt terribly alone and foreboding. I panicked, finally, only for about 20 minutes, but as you know, 20 minutes of panic is about 3 years of most other emotions, visualizing the headline in the local newspaper, idiotic Brit skeleton found, etc. I tried everything, retracing my steps, that didn't work, listening for voices of other hikers, tried my phone for the GPS, but the battery had run out days before. In the end, I decided on going for broke. I'd been walking north. If I just carried on walking north-ish, maybe I'd find the path again. I'd come down a hill, so I picked a hill looking sort of northwards and went up that. And about an hour later, miraculously, I found the path again. I hadn't even been that far from it, but I'd never wanted to kiss dirt more. I noticed a few trees, the bark had been peeling off, and realised in my stupid rushing, I'd probably seen something like that and assumed it was a blaze and taken a wrong turning. I never sneered at stories of people getting lost again, and I didn't get lost on the trail again. Not physically, not emotionally. It's relieving, only having one thing to do for the day, and that's to get where you're going. It's very difficult to worry about anything, to stress about anything when that's all that's in your mental inventory. You spend your waking hours inside nature, traipsing through evolution's imagination and feeling miniature for it. I cannot tell you how beautiful the trail is. It defies words, it defies sight, and inevitably things surface inside you. People you haven't thought about in years, revisiting arguments, revisiting kindnesses, thinking of your parents, of your friends, of your cat. Well, of my cat. I'm always thinking about my cat. You should be thinking about my cat too. And inevitably, you realise just what a stressy dick you've been to yourself for such a long time now. And every day, every minute of every day, I couldn't believe all this beauty had been out there the whole time, millennia before I'd been born, and would still be out there millennia after I die. Physics with trees on top, all of it moving inexorably slowly to its own rhythm, my life a mayfly compared. Yellow birch, mountain maple, beach, all of it towering over you in vermilion kaleidoscopes, mountain peaks pulling away into the horizon, behind and ahead, an entire silent world below that will make you cry if you look at it too long. It's ridiculous. It's absurd. It's America. There was also the beauty of stopping in a town occasionally, the beauty of sleeping in a bed, of ordering extra fries, of getting to walk around the whole day with nothing on one's back. I liked being brought large plates of large American things and getting called hun, feeling like the favourite cat at a Buddhist temple. I learned to regard gas stations with new and enraptured eyes, spending 20 minutes scrutinising the candy section for all the delicious things I was going to take back to my room. Entire fridges stocked with beer. We have so much beer in civilization, I kept thinking. And it's easily accessible. Why am I not drinking it all the time? And in one hiker town, I drank 3 or 4 pints of beer and left for a walk. Just as I was leaving the bar, I noticed why the bartender had been slightly cautious about serving me the last one. The beer was 9%. It kicked in on my walk back to the hotel. I had a little tumble in a ditch by a highway. It's difficult to America when you don't have a car. I noticed that I was exceptionally shit-faced. I got back to the hotel and realised I'd forgotten my room number. The guy working there began insisting they had no record of me. I began insisting that was pretty ridiculous as I'd checked in just that afternoon and I would really like to go to bed, please. He was kind, but clearly thought I was insane, and that just made me more frustrated, arguing with the kind of inverse proportional logic only alcohol can make possible. The less sense your point makes, the stronger you believe it. Just as I was about to start being passive-aggressive, I pulled the keycard out of my pocket and noticed I was, in fact, staying at a completely different hotel. I told him I was going for a quick walk and apologised without explanation. The United States is very strange. I think even our friends living there will agree. It's made weirder for most of us non-Americans having grown up on American television and movies and thinking we all know what the States is like. But Hollywood doesn't mention the miniature toilet stall doors that basically may as well not be there for all they cover and don't cover. Or the way people just say hello and start a conversation with you out of nowhere just because they feel like saying hello. In Europe, this would usually be indicative you're about to get robbed or even a little stabbed, but it works there. It's outgoing, it's kind. I don't know why we don't do this. I also came to adore American television. Halfway through a sports match, the adverts will suddenly come in with, "Senator McLaughlin wants to burn your house down and fuck your goldfish." Okie dokie. I liked hiker towns very much. But after a day or so, a familiar feeling would hit, a kind of longing to get walking again, knowing that all you had to do was go to the supermarket, buy some food and toilet roll, and at any moment of your choosing, you could wander back out into the woods. And every time my Kindle had enough books on it and the IPA hangover wore off, that's exactly what I did. By Tennessee, things were rather comfortable and nice because everyone still on the trail probably meant business and had adapted to trail life. Compared to the people one met in town, hikers lived at a different pace, woke early and slept early, usually had strange and interesting things to say, knew how to remove ticks and throw bear bags. It was a parallel universe, one that became so natural to me that going to resupply in town felt like the imposter reality. I'm not sure I saw a single instance of passive aggression, let alone an argument or a fight on the trail. But my favourite part was the culture of self-sufficiency. Past about 200 miles, everyone was wildly self-sufficient. They weren't rubbing it in your face, you just knew if you gave them a rubber band and a thumbtack and said, "Please build me a voice-activated laser-guided crossbow," they would probably do it. It even started to rub off on me. I liked the days when I was alone, knowing I'd carried myself all this way on my own goofy feet. I liked building fires. I liked finally knowing what poison ivy looks like so I won't have to go another week where I simply just cannot sit down. I liked especially that I wasn't dead, and I must, in part, somehow be responsible for some of that. But I wasn't made of titanium like those other hikers. I hadn't meant to go the whole way anyway. A while in, and I decided I'd probably gotten the message and hung up the phone. A family member had just died, and there was a war going on 2 countries away from where I live these days. Staying in the woods started to seem like I was neglecting my life. This felt like an ending. I caught a ride back down south, near to where I'd started again, enjoyed a bath, and retired my short-lived status as a hiker. There was only one thing left to do in America, the other thing I'd been dreaming about for years, and it was the US Space and Rocket Center in Alabama, Mecca for moon landing obsessives like myself. I hired a car and drove over there for a day, and it was paradise. Full-scale Saturn V's, spacesuits, and an entire hangar full of engineers who'd originally worked on the Apollo program, and you could just walk up and talk to them. So I walked up and talked to them. I'll try and keep this vague to preserve their dignity, but one engineer and I got chatting about an astronaut who'd walked on the moon, not the first famous two, and that said engineer had worked with them. "Oh my God," I said, "you worked with an actual moonwalker. What was he like?" The engineer paused for a second, thoughtfully glanced up at a rocket hanging from the ceiling and said, "Asshole. Total asshole." I very almost piddled my pants. Then a visit to see a friend, and soon enough I was back home in Europe. I laid out my hiking stuff in the corridor of my apartment for a while so I could trip over it and remember how wonderful it had all been. I followed blogs of my trail friends who carried on and lived vicariously through them for a while. But it was strange, because I noticed the Henry David Thoreau wilderness fantasy had finally gone away. This confused me. I hadn't come back with any epiphanies or stories. I wasn't running to my desk to get anything down. Why in the hell did I feel better? I wandered around the apartment for a bit, hung out on the bed with the cat, folded up the laundry. Nope, still me, still the me I'd been before I left. Where had the wilderness thing gone? There's a day on the trail I still think of sometimes, when a mum and her son were kindly giving me a lift into town. The son, maybe 16 or so, ridiculously clever for his age, for any age actually, asked me what I was doing on the trail. I answered I wasn't sure yet, and he said, "You know, a lot of people out there are just trying to," and rolled his eyes for effect, "find themselves." And I thought, I've just carried everything I own for the last few 100 miles through the woods with only my mental illness for company. Woodland creatures with large teeth have been trying to abscond with my food, and last night I took a shit in a snowy hole in the ground. I won't be lectured on lifestyle by an embryo, when I realised, oh, he's probably right, isn't he? Lots of the folks I met on the trail, they were at some transitionary stage in their lives, had just graduated, had just quit a career. Lots were just out there because they liked the quiet and the walking too, but it was definitely a place to go and have a think. I suppose that's why I went too. And no revelation had come of it, which is in itself a sort of revelation, I think. It kind of fell into place one night, months after getting home, when I went for beers with a friend. We laughed our asses off and drank like sailors, and he asked me why I'd gone into the woods in the first place. I told him about the book, about burning a few circuits out, about going loco, and in that irritatingly clever way of boiling what feels like a complex problem down into a soundbite, he said, "So you weren't feeling very inspired?" "No," I said. "And you can't control when you are?" "No," I said. Well, he asked, would you want to control it? And the problem immediately solved itself, because of course I don't want to. Of course no one does, any more than you'd enjoy tickling yourself. Those misguided aha moments are few and far between, but they're rather special for being few and far between. That's what makes them nice. And when you sign up to a lifestyle that involves trying to turn them into something, as I stupidly have, you sign up to them also being unpredictable. That's how it works. That's how it will always work. That's the deal. And the quiet months are part of the deal, one's imagination going dormant for a bit. You have only one job during that catastrophe, and it's to sit tight and remember that it isn't a catastrophe. Your brain will come back online, but you made too many demands and it needs to reset. Sit tight, you idiot. It's just another mini crisis. You got through the others, you barely even remember them now. I got home that night and opened the folder I keep all of my stupid, could be something but probably won't be ideas for stories. They weren't great, but they weren't the disasters I'd seen them as months before when I'd been freaking out. It was the same game I'd always been playing. Everyone is playing. Keep going. Oh, I realised. So glaringly in front of me, only an idiot like myself could miss it. I was supposed to stay here, wasn't I? Here, where home finally is, after decades of searching for one. Here, where my friends are. Here, where I'm me. In weird, imperfect, perfect Bulgaria. I went into the corridor and played with the straps on my hiking backpack for a while, thinking how strange it was that it had contained my entire life for a time, and realised, ultimately, that I am not a hiker. I am a cat. Dogs will come to you for help when they're sick. They need you, and they're not ashamed of it. Cats, in my experience anyway, isolate themselves. They shut down, and most distressingly, when they think they're dying, they go somewhere to die alone. I do the same. Not to die, but getting stuck with a problem in the world, then escaping from the world to try and solve it. Which is not unlike trying to debug code by throwing the computer out the window and joining the circus. This is not a good reason to go to the woods. This is how you go to the woods to try and use them for your own ends, which is not why the trees are there. And I find myself now in this weird position of realizing Christopher McCandless, the hero of Into the Wild, that film I saw what feels like a lifetime ago, had the answer to his own question and to mine, that it was there all along, a line he scribbled in his copy of Dr. Zhivago not long before things went south for him. Happiness is only real when shared. I really thought I could go off and live like a hermit and come back with an answer to myself. But our internal lives aren't equations to solve. There is no master theory of us. We don't arrange things right and forever live the rest of our lives in emotional utopia. It's more a succession of little fires one has to keep putting out, hopefully learning to turn that into a dance. These days, I do not believe, if one is sad or something has broken on the inside, that the answer is a hut in the woods. Of course, there are isolationists, of course there are introverts, of course there are people who just like hiking or living outside and aren't escaping anything. But for those who are low about something or spun waywards by something, in a pinch, I think we often hide from shame when in reality, if we were just honest about what's going on in our heads, our friends would give a damn and try to help. And those friends I've told about my, little dabble with madness back in March with that awful book have all said more or less the same thing, which is, why the hell didn't you tell me? I should have. They would have made jokes, made light of it, and I don't know if they could have fixed the thing, but it certainly would have stopped the problem growing. If you get the urge to take off into the woods, then you crack on. There are so many beautiful, quiet meadows out there just waiting to be chanced upon. I cannot tell you how fantastic your adventures will be. Mine were fun, yours will be better, I'm sure. Go do lots of that, please. But in my limited experience, when I really look back on it, the real adventures were someone you know doing something you don't expect, or trying to remember how you fixed yourself after a blue patch and realizing it was largely thanks to someone standing benevolently in the background of your life and doing it quietly from afar without you even realizing it. I'd even gently suggest that perhaps the strangest adventure, perhaps the most humbling one, happens on the inside. Discovering those parts of yourself you've never acknowledged, jettisoning those parts you've never liked, and constantly, constantly being aware that you will soon turn into someone else. And whoever that is decided at every moment by you now, and in 2 minutes, and 2 minutes after that, until 10 years later, one very long succession of 2 minutes is, you find a new you sitting there, and you're not even sure where they began, nor where they'll end. Which makes us custodians of a sort, looking after this body until a new, hopefully better us inhabits it a while from now. Maybe you know a book called Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. It's very funny, which is weird considering it was written by a Victorian. And in the fashion of popular authors who have their day, then fade into obscurity, he wrote a book a while later called Paul Kevler, which was obscure then and almost completely forgotten now. But I hope it never fades into total forgottenness, just for this passage alone. Returning home on this particular day of days, I paused upon the bridge and watched for a while the lazy barges manoeuvring their way between the piers. It was one of those hushed summer evenings when the air, even of grim cities, is full of whispering voices. And as, turning away from the river, I passed through the white toll gate, I had a sense of leaving myself behind me on the bridge. So vivid was the impression that I looked back, half expecting to see myself still leaning over the iron parapet, looking down into the sunlit water. I think this all just goes on. I think it doesn't stop until we stop. Life phase after life phase, the illusion of understanding inevitably usurped by yet stranger problems arriving, then strangers who arrive in one's life with the solution and are no longer strangers, but friends. That the only control one can ever truly maintain is whether we dance or despair when confronted with such a constant lack of control. Just like Joanna Newsom sang, the nullifying, defeating, negating, repeating joy of life. This constant process of thinking you've got it licked, then starting over again with new problems, completing the final theory of you and the world, and realizing it's just the beginning of a whole new class of theories of you and the world, many of which you'll never solve. And so you say goodbye to final theories. Isn't that okay? I think it's okay. Rediscovering yourself, rediscovering the world, all those basements down there, all those belfries above, isn't it cool being remade? I'll keep walking until I can't, like all of us, off the veranda and out into the blue morning, with friends, I hope, and we'll find more friends and walk with them too, I hope, and blunder and regroup, and blunder and regroup. I hope we'll remember, I hope I'll remember that there's beauty in it all, that we do emerge from darknesses, and we're helped out of them by the offered hands of those we love more often than we scramble out ourselves. I hope we remember that there's beauty in it all, that we do emerge from darknesses, that we're here now, that that's enough, that we do this together, that we do this together. I think that's enough. I think that's enough. And I think that's enough.